financial independence, country shopping, van nomadism, security culture, ethical enclaves, crypto anarchy, legal interstices, survivalism. Join your hosts, Shane and Kyle, as they explore this freedom strategy known as Vaunting. You're listening to the Vaunting Podcast.
And welcome to the Vaunting Podcast, the podcast making you invulnerable to coercion. We're so glad you've decided to tune in because, man, do we have quite the episode for you today. I'm Shane, the world's foremost expert on the subject of Vaunting, only, you know, rivaled by Kyle. And you're here too, right, man?
I'm Kyle.
Yes, you are. Yes, you are. But you know what to do, man.
Well, since governments are the primary coercers upon individuals, the Vaunting Podcast is covered by a BIPCOT no government license. Reuse and modification is permitted to anyone except for governments and the agents thereof. You can learn more at BIPCOT.org.
Okay. And, you know, speaking to the, you know, the world's foremost expert thing, I mean, there's only like two people talking about this subject. So, I mean, it's not really a really hard title to claim at this point. But, you know, hopefully, you know, by us doing this, you know, hopefully I would love to see, you know, a few other podcasts on the subject of Vaunting. That'd be awesome. I think it'd be incredible, you know, if it got, you know, that much attention. People were like, okay, you know, I'm going to start another podcast on Vaunting and, you know, focus on other things, I guess. That'd be pretty neat.
Yeah, we get to have some market competition, as it were.
Yep, so we're in one of those natural monopoly positions.
Yep, pretty much. And the best part about natural monopolies is that the barrier to entry is ridiculously low, at least most of the time.
Yep, that is certainly true. So yeah, man, what's new? I mean, it's been a couple of weeks since we recorded an episode. What you been up to?
Well, let's see. I'm trying to finish out my one temp job, which is either ending this week or next week, depending on what the corporate project management decides, whom, of course, I can't contact directly because that would be going over my boss's head, because that's all wonderful with their hierarchies and such. Meanwhile, I've been basically converting my socialist coworkers to purse.io. With the affiliate marketing code and all that, because I figured, you know, if they're going to annoy me and even some other people in my aisle by yakking when they should be working and I have to turn up like the volume on my headset so I can actually focus on getting my work done, might as well make some money off of them. And the funny part, Shane, is that some of them are actually seriously taking to it. So I haven't got any kickbacks yet, but apparently they've been using my affiliate code. So that's kind of ironic, at least in some sense. Oh, we hate Trump because he's such a fascist and we love Bernie Sanders. Oh, Bitcoin. That's interesting.
Yeah. So do you and if you didn't, I mean, it's not if they're going to pursue it and, you know, get some Bitcoin, that's pretty incredible. But did you tell them about, you can save 15% on everything you buy from Amazon?
Mm-hmm.
You promoted that. Good.
Oh, I'm getting my elevator sales pitch down. I mean, seriously, this is like the first time in my life where I'm actually pretty much being a de facto freelance, you know, salesman of sorts and all that. So, and you know what? Me personally, I'm viewing this as a form of revenge. Because what happened, I think it was during, not to go on too long about this, but, you know, there was that, I think it was during my first month there and when the Obamacare thing was possibly going to be repealed and then somewhat replaced or not or whatever by the Trumpers or whatever the White House people call themselves. It was kind of interesting that in the break room, all the socialists, there was loud noises. Never has happened since. They're saying, no, don't take it away. And it was like everybody in the break room was like, you know what? I'm going to be eating my lunch outside a lot more often.
Yeah, and that's kind of funny. You know, nothing changed. Nothing's really changed.
No, as far as like the political crusading goes. And now I'm turning around in my favor where I'm just going to basically try and make money off of them. And that, I think, would be the best market approach, right? Make money off of your sworn enemies.
Right. It reminds me of when I interviewed Ben Stone for the other podcast I do, and he was like, you know, I thought, you know, it'd be great, you know, listen to Libertarian team to go, you know, get, you know, print out Che shirts and you know, go sell those to the Black Lives Matter people. If you can make a buck off them, why not? But yeah, that's pretty awesome. And I guess since it is a temp job and, you know, it's coming to an end, I mean, you could go real anarchist with it, right? You could, you're all a bunch of socialists. You could pull off a Mises. I mean, unless you're looking to get rehired, but.
Even if I did pull off a Mises, according to that one event that I think was by Milton Friedman, I think said at one of their economic summits, Mises got so fed up that he said, you're all a bunch of socialists, and basically walked out of the room like a boss. I don't know, man. I might consider doing something like that. And the sad part is they probably would re-up me.
Yeah.
that's kind of the sad part. Because yeah, I mean, the atmosphere is kind of politically charged, but again, that's a different topic for another time. Don't want to take up too much time here, but suffice it to say, and answer the question, what I've been up to. I think there's that other time, grammar work or whatever it was.
Oh boy,
I've got stories to tell, but again, tale for another time.
Yeah. Yeah. And I guess what one thing for me, which is actually very relevant to what we're going to discuss today, which I'll get to here in a moment, Free Isles and Free Ports. But I'm actually, I was approached by some folks from the Marinilla Project, and they're trying to start a village at sea somewhere out. It's a Quetzal Bank. It's kind of not centrally located, but, in between Cuba, the Bahamas, and Florida. Like the southern tip, obviously. They approached me, and they heard one of the podcasts I did talking about seasteading and stuff, and they reached out to me, and now I'm their communication specialist, so I'll be doing a third podcast, and it will be on, Freeport, the seasteading sort of thing, kind of what we'll talk about that some today, and then also next week, but I'm really looking forward to that project, and the way it overlaps with everything I'm doing right now is just it's pretty crazy.
Yeah, I can only imagine, man. But I guess that's something about entrepreneurship that really only people who are self-driven or entrepreneurial themselves could really appreciate, is that you've got to manage your time and doing the belt balancing act thing. If people think that being managerial is difficult, try being an entrepreneur, because things get real exciting real quickly, even if you're not necessarily freelancing.
Right. And it's kind of interesting with me, like when I was, it's when I was higher level indoctrination, not really, just doing that and not working and having a lot of free time. I did less than I do now. And isn't it like inertia, like body in motion stays in motion, I think it is.
Something like that.
Yeah. Like I've noticed that now, because now we obviously have a full time job, and then now I'm doing three podcasts, and that's on top of, the other projects I'm doing. So pretty interesting stuff. And yeah, it overlaps very nicely with what we're going to talk about tonight. So this episode is titled Free Isles and Free Ports, the Founding of New Libertarian Countries, and the extensive show notes can be found at VonniePodcast.com/16. This will be a beginning. This will be the beginning of a miniseries on localized areas of liberty discussed by Rayo. They are free isles, free ports, and intentional communities, and local congregations. And I'll begin by saying that we initially thought it would be best to start with, the various case studies of attempts at founding new libertarian countries, and then move on to what Rayo had to say about them. But, after further thought, Rayo and the folks at Preform Inform are actually influential in at least the Atlantis Project, if not the others, too. So, figured it'd be best to start out with what Rayo had to say and then touch upon those various case studies next week. So at that time, I'll speak for myself here, but I do believe that, Rayo was correct in his reasoning as to, why him and other Preform informers abandoned the project. So we'll talk more about, the efficacy of this strategy nowadays in season three. And, my involvement with the Marinilla Project will certainly, feed into that, at least to some extent. But yeah, you think, Rayo was correct in his reasoning for abandoning it? At least initially, before we get into it?
Yeah, I think, well, remember too, I mean, the whole sovereign freeport thing was an experiment, at least in some sense, or at least exploring the efficacy of it, right? And, generally speaking, I agree with Rayo about this. And so, yeah, that's what we're going to pretty much focus on tonight is, what were the ins and outs and what he had to say about it, and, what was the point, right? Why bother setting up a so-called libertarian country, or dare shall I say it, libertarian city-state government? Oh God, it's just, yeah. I don't know. Can I feel a little bit of political crusading here? Just a wee bit.
Yeah. Yeah, there is that. And then I guess one other note here, and this won't be covered. Well, maybe it'll be covered in next week's. But yeah, I mean, the folks, the Preform Inform folks, the Free Owls Project, yeah, they did settle on a minimal government. But yeah, we'll get in more into that next week. But and, you know, at some point, Kyle, you know, you've been definition man for a while. But I think, you know, this episode we'll keep it that way. And then next week we'll switch because, you know, I do want to get some, you know, some rotation going and such. But definitions. So Free Owls and Freeports, what did Radio define those as?
Well, as described in March 1965 innovator Preform's Free Isle, I guess would be defined as a sovereignly independent commercial freeport, literally a small new nation.
Yes, that is the case. And it was interesting because I initially had them like separate, you know, Free Owls and Free Ports, thinking they were two different things. But no, he kind of grouped both of those things up. And obviously, as we get into season three, we'll kind of, I think there's definitely some different applications of what Rayo is kind of, you know, going after here. And it doesn't have to be, you know, all inclusive kind of how he portrayed it. There was one thing I did add, Kyle, you know, before we started recording this. And I think, you know, some context as far as, you know, so I think some context would be a good idea, you know, to give an idea of Rayo's line of thinking. So I'm going to read a couple of paragraphs here just real quick to show you, like, because this is a self-seeking Free Owls chapter in his book. And I do think it kind of lends into, you know, why he was, you know, thinking about these various subjects. So I'll go ahead and do that real quick. Quote, "How can you increase your freedom? This is the theme of self-seeking. A continuing and formal exploration of various ways for realizing greater personal opportunity in the present world. The range of interest of self-seeking is the lifespan of its readers. Self-seeking is looking for approaches to freedom that will yield results within a few decades at most, and which will directly benefit the liberators. Likewise, self-seeking examines ways for living more efficaciously in society as it is." And I'm going to skip forward a little bit. But even the more optimistic prognosticators do not foresee significant economic political fruits of a cultural revolution in this century. More pessimistic forecasts, taking into account the probability of further massive government intervention in control over education and communications, if not overt censorship, place results centuries away. Long-range cultural revolution activities are not, of course, to be deprecated merely because they will not bring freedom in our lifetime. Not only can an individual gain personal satisfaction by helping a revolution on its way, but a career in the education or communications field may bring about tangible profits as well. And, you know, I'll skip forward a little bit here. He's just talking about, you know, choosing professions where you can influence, you know, minds to libertarianism. But skipping forward, are there ways to bring about a cultural revolution much more quickly than have been thought possible, say within a decade or two? The above example suggests that some mechanism for enabling individuals to realize an immediate tangible return from converting others would be a potent catalyst. And last one for the moment here. Attempting to vastly accelerate constructive cultural change is one general approach to freedom in our time. Another is the creation of localized areas of liberty in an otherwise unfree world. So that's kind of the line of thinking that Rayo was going down. And you know, Kyle, is kind of, as we talked about in season one, him being against the collective movementism thing, it's interesting to see him propose, you know, these strategies such as like Free Owls and Freeports, and then even kind of some, I don't know, some other stuff too, obviously. But it's kind of interesting to see him, you know, at least like, you know, putting some sort of, you know, merit into some of these activities. So I guess anything you want to add there before we, you know, get into what Rayo had to say specifically about Freeports and Free Owls?
I think it's important to keep in mind that Rayo was writing these articles over a period of time. And in some ways, kind of like how I've, up until these past couple months, I've been kind of having my flirtatious affair with last-ditch minarchism, essentially, which is what polyarchy is. It seems to me, quite frankly, that it's almost like Rayo is kind of having last ditch. Because remember, the cultural revolution is part of that collective movementism, of course. So it's almost like this was like a last ditch collective movementism of a kind. Like he knows it's bad, but like, could it even possibly work, even in very utilitarian sense, of course, because Rayo was an engineer, as we've covered before. So that's kind of where it's at. Like, could it even hypothetically work, even despite all the philosophical problems involved and so forth?
Yeah, and I think one more kind of thing to add on there is it's kind of like, you know, it seems like his vision or his, like, I guess his viewpoint on, you know, sort of those more of the collective sorts of things, you know, kind of, you know, like with these, and then it got smaller and smaller. Like he kind of eventually got to like Vanu communities and you know, Vanu co-ops. And then it was just this progression to like, okay, screw everybody. Like, I'm done.
you could
kind
see
of, kind of how it went for him. So yeah, I think there is kind of a progression here. Like, okay, like political crusading is bad. Then you have, you know, like, okay, free houses and free ports. You know, this seems like, like interesting ideas that could be promising. Okay, yeah, now, yeah, no. Okay, well, what about Vana communities? Okay, well, interesting. No, I'm done.
Yeah, or at most it would be something like an ethical enclave. Please see previous episode on ethical enclaves. And that's just kind of like, that's like the most groupy it got, arguably, unless we're talking about intentional communities, which of course is going to be its own thing. But yeah, I mean, that's just kind of what it is. It's kind of like, okay, if we do the groupy thing of one flavor or another, what possible versions of doing collective movementism, despite its philosophical problems, could, in a very strictly utilitarian sense, even has a small chance of possibly working in some circumstances if just magically the right variables happen to line up with the stars, because determinism and all that. And that almost kind of seems to be kind of the idea here is, you know, can enough people get together to do X and set up our to actually use a phrase from Konkin, because he was very derisive about this, the anarcho-Zionism, right? Mm-hmm. The running away to the promised land of liberty. And Rhea was more like, well, could we run away to the promised land of liberty by setting up a libertarian, you know, municipal city-state government? And I think Rhea was just more exploring, trying to keep an open mind about it. And then, yeah, he came to the conclusion that he eventually came to.
Yeah, right. So let's get into what Rayo had to say. And unfortunately, there's not a whole lot, at least at this point. Once we start acquiring, you know, other libertarian publications, you know, especially Preform, Inform, like this was their main goal for quite some time. So I imagine if we come across, you know, publications from 1960 and 1965 at Preform, Inform, oh man, there'd be a lot to go over. But as far as, you know, Rayo's book, there's only a couple of excerpts. So we'll go ahead and cover those now. Quote, "The most ambitious scheme for a local area of freedom so far proposed, a sovereign freeport, would potentially have much to offer. The Free Isle residents would hypothetically have all of the advantages of participating in world commerce while being free from taxes and regulations. Furthermore, a Free Isle, if it were successful, could be a very effective demonstration of the merits of laissez-free capitalism, or laissez-faire capitalism," end quote. So, I mean, yeah, I agree, hypothetically, right?
Well, it's a very polyarchist argument, isn't it? Essentially that, well, we can have a free market and governance and all that. Hell, there were even previous episodes of LUA Radio where I was actually kind of arguing that position in favor of that, right? Whereas now I'm a lot more skeptical of it, to put it politely. So yeah, so we can have these decentralized competing quasi-free market governments or whatever, which free market governments, what the hell is that? Because government's a monopoly and a couple other things. So right there you have a contradiction. There is no such thing. I mean, you would think that the American experiment in limited government kind of proved that democracy or no democracy, you can't really have these hypothetically limited governments that are kind of minimal, right? We're basically, like with the 13 colonies, they were essentially 13 governments. Actually, well, they had each had their own constitutions, right? And they would hypothetically compete. And then people could, you know, if they didn't like Massachusetts, they could go to Georgia. And if they didn't like North Carolina, they could go to friggin' New York and so forth, right? And so you could say the founding fathers themselves were very polyarchist in many respects, maybe not necessarily to the degree here where it's, you know, strictly a free market, but close, I guess, because shades of gray, because reasons. I don't know. But yeah, I don't know, man. It's just kind of like, this is last ditch minarchism. That's exactly what the hell this is. It's like, can we have like minimal statism? Can we please have like the nicest version of consensual rape? Can we please have, you know, the voluntary compliance of like the tax system or something? You know, it's really, you know what it is? You know what the hell it is? It's a square peg in a round hole. That's exactly what it is. And it's an interesting thought experiment. And Lord knows I've done it, too. I'm even on the public record doing so. But sometimes the best of us make mistakes. in terms of reasoning and so forth. And part of like being rational is kind of admitting your mistakes and then correcting it. And I think it's kind of the same here. It's like, okay, guys, square peg, round hole, you know. And to be fair, on my part, there was some economic illiteracy too, which I've been trying to correct. You know, I finished Human Action, Mises Human Action, and some other things. So I think that that could also be very effective too in terms of getting people away from the state, getting people out of the state, have encouraging them to cancel their voter registration or aversions on a theme thereof. And yeah, economic education, I think is part of that too, so that when you have people in a very trying to promote various methods of what may or may not be direct action, such as let's set up our own country or let's do the Freeport thing, which is a variation thereof. It's kind of like, OK, guys, let's like sit down for an hour or two or even 5 minutes and just think about this before, you know, sinking money, you know, down a rat hole.
Yeah. Yeah, and I guess the kind of influence here that might be worth mentioning is that, you know, from the more I find out about Rayo from other folks, obviously I can't, you know, there's no firsthand, you know, firsthand information on this, but he does bring up Ayn Rand a lot, but he kind of idolized Ayn Rand as far as I could see. But anyways, so I guess maybe his views on government were similar there, but you know, like then, you know, from reading Brian Doherty's Radicals for Capitalism, you know, like in the 60s, I mean, the idea of anarchism was like, especially like the market variety of anarchism, was very, very new. And like, even like the libertarians, you know, like them very many, many, many statists, they were, you know, like they, you know, they even called, you know, anarchists extremely radical. So like, I do think, you know, the, especially that last part could be a very effective demonstration of the merits of laissez-faire capitalism. Even then, well, then of course it would have been, you know, nice. But now, you know, if one of these, you know, free ports could be set up to where, you know, laissez-faire capitalism isn't just hypothetical or theoretical, and you know, at least to trying to find the best way to word this. Obviously, I guess. Well, I mean, yeah, having that example where like, okay, so there's no regulations, there's no taxes, and everything's fine. People are, you know, prospering. There's no it's not complete chaos as the socialists would have you believe. So I think that today would even be you know, a very like very, very important, you know, thing if it could actually be done. You know, so I guess I'm just that's all I've got there.
Well, you know, man, the minarchists, you know, in one sense, I want to be nice to them, but in the other sense, because I was one of them at one point. And then in another regard, you know, it's almost like they're the worst apologists for statism in some ways, because it's like, well, we could live with it. And I don't know, it kind of seems to be like, oh, we can just set up our own government. You know, may not necessarily be that to tick off an even larger group of people. You know, going off and setting up your own government may not be that many shades of gray away from the oxymoronic sovereign citizens, too. Right. Again, controlled schizophrenia one more time. And it's just like, yeah. And so the perspective the minarchists have, whether it's the objectivists or the constitutionalist American patriots or versions on a theme thereof, have of people who are of the no government persuasion is basically, oh, you're all the black bloc kids. Despite the fact that Voltairine de Cleyre and others were kind of against all that kind of stuff even before the black bloc thing was a black bloc thing. So basically when it comes to, you know, even dabbling, dare shall I say, with no government, or just privatize everything, as Dr. Walter Block would put it, whenever he's not politically crusading for Trump, it's kind of just sad that all the minarchists are like, you basically, all of you people of no government, you're basically of the European tradition, not the American tradition, which is a very propertarian, basically private property without government and so forth. And then it's like, oh, okay, so the minarchists now just went full on authoritarian in terms of the demonization thing. And so even when it comes to a form of possible direct action or even asking the question or trying to evaluate whether setting up your own government or a free port or hell, even a private city. You know, I mean, is that just collective movementism one more time? Is that just dare shall I say, if there was a certain contract with a nation state to like a special economic zone, like they got zones like they've got in China, right? Isn't that just kind of more of the same? It's just, it seems edgy, it seems new and different. But then again, you know, political crusaders have been trying to convince people that voting yourself to freedom is also some new radical thing, because, you know, we've got, because apparently Ron Paul equals Donald Trump, apparently. Or so they would have you believe. And that's rather interesting. And so it kind of would seem to be, well, we can set up our own government, and that's somehow completely different from what the founders did. It's like, well, wait a minute. No, if you set up a government, you set up a government. It's a monopoly. Okay. So, you know, constitutionality and whatever aside, it's just kind of like, what the hell? I mean, yeah, I guess there's the issue about legal interstices, but that's more after the fact. Because if anything, if there was the question about setting up your own government, setting up a private city, setting up a free port, and then what are the legal issues, and, you know, is it really truly sovereign free port, or is it more like a province, you know, type of thing of like a nation state, and there's just this treaty and everything hinges on the terms of the treaty because it's like a contract, sort of. But it's a contract with a monopoly entity that's still government. So you're not really getting away from living without rulers. At that point, you're just asking for permission to be, I guess, somewhat invulnerable to coercion on a good day. But at that point, it's almost like politically crusading so that you can have an legal interstice later.
Yeah, and that's what I was going to say. Like, how and this would, you know, be directly relevant to Vani, right? I mean, do these you know, strategies really make you more invulnerable to coercion, or does it just make you even an even bigger target of the state? But yeah, let me read this last one. I think we'll have this last excerpt, and then I think we'll have some more stuff to discuss on this one. So, quote, "With such advantages go sizable difficulties. Acquiring land for a sovereignly independent free isle requires a special treaty with a source nation. A very substantial amount of capital would probably be required to interest the government of even a small, underdeveloped country in parting with some of its own territory. And the reaction of other governments to such a venture poses potential hazards. Preform now fears that economic isolationism by the U.S. and other states, if it comes, will annul much of the economic potential for a free isle," end quote. You know, I'm glad he's kind of recognizing this. But even if it's just like a floating platform with like an international waters, not, you know, purchasing land from another country, because that was one of the things that kind of hypothesized was, well, what about just like a platform in international waters? That would be better. That would certainly be better. But I mean, there's obviously difficulties for all of these things. But yeah, I mean, he's talking directly about, you know, buying land from a government or buying land from a nation state, and then you know, opening up that free isle or sovereign free port. So there's certainly some issues there.
No kidding. I mean, that would require lobbyists. That would require capital investment on a scale. I mean, if people think private roads, and I'm talking stupid toll road, fascist, public-private partnership crap. I'm talking about a real, fully private, 100% real private road, like what legally is an interstice right here in Texas. Dang, dude. How do I say this? It's just, I don't think people are really kind of thinking this through, whether it's like something like a Liberland or something else. It would require so much political crusading to even get the treaty that Rayo here is mentioning. Never mind the capital investment far exceeding that of a private road.
Yes, and when we get to next week, we'll start talking about dollars. And keep in mind, this was like the 60s and 70s. And to give you, I guess, one other example, the Marinilla Project is looking for $15 million for phase one. So yeah, a lot of capital investment there. That's no joke. And then one other, and this was raised by I can't remember where. I don't remember which reference this came from. Might have been one of the ones on the Vani website, or it might have been, you know, Brian Doherty's Radicals for Capitalism. But another thing that kind of, you know, doesn't come up until, you know, it's kind of too late after all that capital has been dumped into it is, well, who's gonna move there? Like, if you're starting up like a village at sea, like, well, who's gonna move there? Like, it's kind of seems to be something that is kind of not thought of until after the fact. Like, okay, we've got this thing, you guys coming? No. Well, darn. Well, I don't know what we're going to do now. So I guess that would kind of, be something that Rhea would have to consider here, or at least the folks in Preform and Inform. And I don't think they really, I mean, as far as that last paragraph, they don't really mention that.
How much capital do people have these days, you know, hiding underneath the couch cushions to basically invest in their own mini state?
They probably would have been better in the 60s and 70s than, you know, projects like that now, because they had like outlets like the Volcker Fund, and, you know, the Koch brothers were obviously kind of involved there. And there were a couple of other, you know, major, you know, funding houses for libertarian projects. So, you know, they would have had a better chance there, but obviously, and we'll get into this next week, but the other projects, typically it was some like tycoon who had a bunch of money to blow anyways. So that kind of seems to be, you know, the where that capital is coming from. So, yeah, some issues for sure.
Well, I would also think that the analogy, for lack of a better word, would be you have to be able to walk in a straight line before you can run a marathon. And setting up your own country or a free isle or a free port or a private city, perhaps, which seems to be the modern lingo, private city and all that, I think that's really biting off more than one can chew, I think is really kind of what I'm getting at. Let me put it this way, man.
And H level Vanu, when we're talking like mean time to harassment, like this is like...
Yes.
Yeah,
this is so far out.
Most people can't even do like A, B, and C level, but hey, let's go start up a sovereign free port. Okay.
And I'm glad you brought up MTH, because that's a way of conceptual, and yes, please refer to the MTH episode from season one. That MTH scale, which measures the strength of Vanu, is kind of a realistic, like, put one foot in front of the other and see how far you can go with it, right? And you're right. I mean, a lot of people either won't or can't do A-level Vanu, but then, you know, you've got these venture capitalists of one kind or another, who some of them may very well be genuine and other ones may be less so, as in the sense that they're really fascists, and I'll leave it to the listeners to make their own, you know, judgments as to which are which. But suffice it to say, there's a lot of lucrative government contracts where they make their money from and so forth, due to various other reasons that would take another episode on a completely different topic to explain how all that works. Government contracting and all that. So what I'm getting at is this, you know, follow the money, because that's where this is coming. Or shall I say the ferns, those Federal Reserve notes, follow the ferns. Where are they coming from? Where are they going? Because I can tell you that people, kind of what we mentioned, I think it was in the financial independence episodes, something to the effect of, you know, people who were, you know, regarding like wealth and freedom, right? You know, do you need a lot of wealth in order to be free? And I think regarding, you know, a private city-esque type thing, which is what we're discussing here tonight, I think we're kind of running headlong, kind of in some ways, back to that same question. Because, I don't think that's something that a lot of people have thought of. And so, yeah, there's the collective movementism aspect of it. And there's also the legal aspect of it, like, would there be a treaty? Would there not be a treaty? Rayo definitely thinks there was would be a treaty, and I agree with him about that, at least to some extent. But then there's the financial end of it. So even if you could get 100,000 people on your side, and they're committed, and even more committed than the whole, you know, free state project nonsense.
I'd even say like 10 or 15,000. Like, let's keep this, you know, more realistic.
Okay, let's say 5,000. I don't know. We can start with a really small colony, basically. Whatever the number turns out to be. Even if you got your critical mass, but you have mass apparently in some sense, and even if you could somehow figure out all the legal stuff, maybe there was an interstice or two you could exploit, quite possibly, depending on the nature of the legal system you're dealing with, run by the monopoly government. Well, then there's the issue of, where are the ferns? Where's the capital? And I don't know, man. It almost seems to me that there's some well-intentioned people that are promoting capitalism of one flavor or another who actually, ironically, don't have any capital to actually invest in much of anything, much less a private city or a free isle or a free port or any of this other stuff, so that when you have authoritarians hear us talk about stuff like this in a more, you know, pro sense, in favor of it, they kind of view us like utopians because they're not because a lot of these discussions, you know, even with one guy here locally in town who's very much a polyarchist, you know, it's kind of like, you know, dude, you know, I admire your optimism and such, and you're definitely well intentioned, but you know, the path to hell is
well and well ahead of most other people too.
Sure, yeah, but then again, like I told him in private conversation, like I'm farther along the line than he is. And, you know, the path, you know, like St. Bernard of Clairvaux said, the path to hell is paved with good intentions. And I'm really kind of leaning more towards this whole private city thing of one version or another is such a good intention. Like, yes, hypothetically, you know, X should lead to Y, which leads to Z and so forth, you know, chain of causation. But you also have to consider a lot of that stuff from season one. I mean, look at the nature of the servile society, how in goodness sakes name can you go from servile society to some sort of libertarian free port, whatever the heck, where essentially private property is respected and you have your like anarchic DRO private defense agency type thing. Or maybe not even to that extent, but even just have a truly limited government. Because remember, there's that issue too, because some people want a constitution. We just want an even more limited constitution than the already hypothetically limited constitution that James Madison was essentially the father of. And he was against central banking.
Right, and then so this just came into mind, but speaking of defense, you know, concealment, defense, deception, and then maybe the other one or two that Rayo talked about, mobility might have been one of, or deterrence and whatever, the things he mentioned in his book, you know, as far as defense for one of these things and you know, in relation to invulnerability to coercion, and this was something, you know, thankfully, you know, that one of the guys I was talking to from the Marinilla Project, and this was a very good point. It's not something I'd really, I guess I really hadn't thought this logically through. It kind of, you know, slapped me across the face, but like one of these sovereign free ports, I mean, your defense is I mean, maybe from like pirates or, you know, thieves, like maybe you'd be fine there. But, you know, if the Empire, the United States Empire, comes after you, they send, you know, a couple gunboats and you're, I mean, there's no way you're going to defend against that, right? You're just toast. And you really can't do guerrilla warfare on the water as far as I know, right?
Well, there might be ways of actually making that work. The point, though, is that in terms of before there's any sort of armed conflict, like what's the background, what's the setting for it? And quite frankly, you know, when it comes to a private city or free isle type thing, man, what we're really talking about is a type of permanent autonomous zone, because it's permanent, it's stationary, at least presumably so. And it's very interesting that almost nobody wants to mention about temporary autonomous zones, which are mobile and therefore would be, I guess, more Vanu friendly, at least to some extent. So
yes, it could be like, you know, those food trucks that drive around to like offices and like serve the employees. It could be something like that. That would be, you know, probably better, like, yeah. You know, like a mobile like sovereign free port, so to speak, yeah. Where you just kind of, you know, cruise around to, oh, you know, just tweet it out. Hey, the sovereign free port will be in your area. Come buy weed. Or whatever it is.
Yeah. Yeah, and that would be an ethical enclave at that point, you know, and the stuff we've already discussed in that particular episode regarding how that works.
Well, would it be an ethical enclave if it's not illegal out there and if there's no collectivist government over the top of it?
Okay, well,
it'd be voluntary exchange. But anyways,
that would, okay, fair. Well, okay, yeah, I guess we could play games of legal interstices too. Fair enough. But whether it be an ethical enclave or whether it be not that because of interstices or whatever, the point, though, is that between the two, yeah, I mean, hell, it could even be a – remember, you and I have talked about submarines before. So there, why can't the Free Isle be like a submarine? I mean, you got the mobility, and it would be – I don't remember exactly the letter offhand. We've discussed this before in the MTH episode, but it would be kind of up there in terms of the MTH. So it's not something you can just, like, you know, do today. But yeah, I mean, I think that would be a lot better than rather than trying to get some static piece of land and hope that everything goes well. And even if it does initially go well, that it doesn't, you know, completely completely get you know, run over or taken over. I mean, hell, to use a fictional example, you know, there was that video game BioShock, and like all of the events take place in Rapture, which is essentially an underground city that takes place in an alternate time period in the 1960s or thereabouts. Right. Yeah, time period. Right. And that, too, had a very heavy objectivist influence and so forth. And it's very interesting that it would be like almost impossible to like nuke an underground city. And so, yeah, Rapture was essentially a private city and it was a permanent autonomous zone. That's true. But what kept it like invulnerable to coercion, at least until the tragedy of what kicked the video games off, which I'm not going to go into here. But what essentially kept it invulnerable to coercion was the fact that it was under the water. Like, is it even possible to like nuke an underwater city? Like, it's never I think it would be one heck of an experiment, I guess, if people really wanted to pull it off, I suppose. But, you know, water is one heck of a buffer. And there's the issue of water pressure. So, yeah, it would damage the water or at least down and kill a lot of sea life. Sure. But actually, like hurting the underwaters. No, I don't think so. So unless there's some sort of like natural barrier like that, then a permanent autonomous zone, whether it's a private city or free ally or whatever else, at least kind of makes some sense, because that's, again, dependent on reality, not legalities. Legalities being things like a special treaty with a source nation, as Rayo put it. The water, the depth of the water would actually be the actual protective barrier. Or with the submarine. The mobility of the submarine would keep it invulnerable to coercion, right? Again, reality, not legality. And I don't know, it almost seems like Rayo here was almost kind of focusing more on the legal interstices, at least to some sense, because he was still assuming like, we have our land. We just need to ask permission from some sort of, you know, third world government that's desperate for economic improvement, kind of like how the Chinese were decades ago, which is why they set up special economic zones, such as in Shenzhen and so forth. And of course, those areas are like ridiculously profitable for the communists that live there and so forth. So that's kind of interesting, isn't it? So that kind of enabled some parasitism, doesn't it? And that is very interesting to kind of realize, is that, okay, even if you set up a private city, even if you were able to get the special treaty with the source nation, if, then what makes you think that the hosting government wouldn't try to kind of like, that looks very productive. I think we'll steal a little bit of it. We'll keep our parasitism and our predatory theft and such. We'll keep it measured. We'll have like 1% sales tax instead of something a lot higher or whatever. We won't have an income tax, but we'll have a property tax, right? So in terms of being invulnerable to coercion, I'm just not seeing it here. Unless there's some sort of either a natural barrier or, as you were mentioning, the submarine, there's some sort of mobility involved with the permanent autonomous zone. But again, if it's really mobile, I guess it would be more temporary. Yeah, it would be more of a TAS at that point. Right. So if we're talking, and also one other thing, too, regarding the second realm, I know some people might consider a private city to be kind of like part of a second realm or something, but personally, I just don't see it. Because again, if Vanu is about reality, not legality, see, there's that temptation to kind of backslide toward, I mean, and to be perfectly fair, ladies and gentlemen,
Rayo was guilty of it too.
Moi included. I mean, I have that temptation to, I mean, you know how I think about, you know, interstices and how to exploit and all that, but that's also because of my current living conditions as well. I mean, so it's kind of, again, it's the fallback position, but I kind of fall back on it like a crutch a little too often, even for my tastes. But the idea here is if Vanu is about achieving or the condition thereof of an invulnerability to coercion, the question here that we're trying to kind of explore and try to get something close to an answer about is that, are free isles and free ports truly a effective way to increase one's invulnerability to coercion? And quite honestly, Shane, I just don't see it.
Sure, Ev, I don't know exactly what you mean, but that sounds a whole lot like questions answered for season three. But we might have dabbled a little bit in season three here, but it's kind of unavoidable, you know, to at least kind of mention some of that stuff. But But yeah, that's all Rayo had to say about, you know, Free Isles and Freeports, at least until we get our hands on those preform and form publications. And again, there are, you know, some possible opportunities for that. So I've got, I've got a handful of leads and people following up on stuff for me. So, hopefully at least one of them will pan out. Right. So, now I guess the next thing that, that'd be kind of interesting to talk about and it kind of prepares for next week's episode is, kind of discussing, Preform's influence on future nation building projects. And then also, Rayo specifically, his notoriety, there was a college professor, PhD, I think, who wrote the white papers on the Vani website, VaniPodcast.com, where she actually, examined, libertarian, micronations. So this was like, something in like a college academic journal, which is pretty neat if you ask me. So his kind of notoriety was kind of centered around, his work with the Free Isles Project. And that's kind of, the start that, this Preform Inform folks got too, although I don't really know any of them by name, at least up to this point. But that's kind of where, where his notoriety and their notoriety kind of came from, was the Free Isles Project. After that, obviously, most of the comments, when Preform Inform went, when they were, pioneering survivalism, or they were living out in the woods and stuff, obviously, there are a lot of negative comments and derisive comments about them then. But even, just the Free Isles Project, there was still, the anarcho-Zionism thing that, Konkin called them anarcho-Zionists. Rothbard calling them retreatists. He was talking about those folks. So it just kind of got worse because it went from like the anarcho-Zionism to the retreatists. So that's kind of, I don't know if that's as far as notoriety. I mean, it was mostly derisive in nature. But nonetheless, I mean, that's kind of where their notoriety came from.
Well, yeah, and notice too, the critics of it, right? I mean, Rothbard unfortunately was a political crusader, so that kind of threatened his own interests, or at least would possibly siphon away enough market share, if you will, in some sense, away from the political crusading he was doing with the anti-libertarian LP, right? And some other forms of political crusading, and then Konkin, who is firmly against political crusading. He also didn't want to kind of siphoned off from more kind of ethical enclave activity because he probably formed his view of competition that he didn't want people getting distracted by. At least that's kind of my speculation as far as that goes. So it's almost like you have this different competition in the market of ideas really kind of going on here, right? Should we try and reform the state from the inside? Should we try and increase black market activity? Should we try and go for our own government?
The education, should we, just continue to pursue educational efforts, et cetera, yeah.
Yeah, well, you know how I think about that one. But yeah, it's just kind of like, look, I appreciate people actually trying to focus on either direct action or even the political crusading to an extent in the sense of more the mechanics of it. Like, does, in a value-free, dare shall I say, praxeological sense, does grassroots lobbying actually make any sense and so forth? So I think that's better than just, complaining about the latest so-called tragedy in the news cycle, which, oh, by the way, does anybody even remember what happened last week with the Trump administration? And see, a lot of people just don't because the problem with the news cycle is the short memory span and so forth. So I think discussions about actually doing things is a lot more productive. And so in terms of doing the thing of setting up a free port and what would go into it and how that would work, there's some pretty... this isn't nuance and minutia, ladies and gentlemen. This is fundamentals to how the method would work, if you could make it work. And that's a very, very big if. And quite frankly, I think at this point what it's going to come down to is, if not a praxeological a priori, I would assume to be a critique of this kind of thing, then at the very least an empirical, more utilitarian, going case study by case study and seeing, in human experience, any attempts at even getting close to something like these Free Isles, like did somebody actually manage to pull it off successfully?
Yes, yes. And obviously, like, you know, when we were going over what Rayo had to say, there were some hypotheticals, you know, hypothetical situations we brought up. But, you know, next week, some of those will become concrete. And there's actually one really terrible example, you know, I guess one terrible in the sense that, you know, really, you know, negative ramifications stemmed from it. But yeah, we'll they'll turn from, you know, theoretical and hypothetical to more concrete ones. So I think to kind of, you know, tease you for next week. And to kind of, you know, bring you know, the Free Owls Project to a close. Rayo actually wrote a letter to Werner Stifel of the Atlantis Project. I think the newspaper was the Atlantis News, and they made a comment about Rayo and the Free Owls Project. You know, they made some claim and it was incorrect. So Rayo wrote to him and corrected it, and they printed it in the Atlantis News. And this is one portion of that. This was on Roy Halladay's website. That article is mirrored on the Vonnie website. You can go read that. It's a fascinating story. This is what Rayo said. Quote, "It was essentially a study group to examine the feasibility and do advanced planning of a laissez-faire freeport. At accomplishing this, it was generally successful. After 2 years, most participants concluded that such a free isle was probably not feasible. The single most important reason for not proceeding with implementation, not mentioned in your article, was the increasing harassment and threats of the U.S. and other major governments against international movements of capital, people, and goods on which free isles, as conceived, would depend. Present-day activities under the name Preform concern self-liberation through neo-nomadic living, not the freeport development." End quote. So, you know, obviously, Kyle, you know, I really knew about that was just the introduction to and Rayo's book that was written by, I presume, John Fisher. And it just kind of seemed like, you know, Rayo got sick of it, sick of all talk and, you know, one of these things not coming into fruition. And he decided to, you know, pursue Vanu. But no, apparently, you know, after a couple of years, it just kind of, you know, came to a natural close and the focus shifted. So that's kind of, you know, another, you know, kind of an interesting thing. And I have a feeling once we, you know, when we get more information on Rayo, I don't think we're going to be wrong about a whole lot. But I think we may just, you know, have additional details which clarify some things where which, you know, aren't that clear just based off of, you know, the lack of information. So
right, and also one something very important to keep in mind just from the time frame here. This that excerpt you read was published in 1969, so the articles that make up the Vanu book are throughout the 60s and early 70s. So this was during that same time period. And so Rayo openly admitted to Stifel, and let me reread that one portion. Most participants, this is about Preform Inform, right? Most participants concluded that such a free isle was probably not feasible. Was probably not feasible. That's it. So they actually tried, seriously, in a very utilitarian manner, presumably, to see, could we actually pull this off? And if most of the participants are saying no, and again, the single most important reason increasing harassment and threats to the U.S. and other major governments against international movements of capital, period. And then he goes on to mention about how that's with the Free Isles Project. And then with Preform, concerned self-liberation through neo-nomadic living, not the Freeport development. So I think Rayo mentioned, you know, the Free Isle or Freeport idea because it's kind of like part of his history. Not as actually something serious. So it's like, so in other words, it was part of his history. It was something he looked at. So it is part of his life. It's part of his anti-political development, for lack of a better phrase. So it's not something to just ignore. But at the same time, the question was, well, what was the result? What was his, at least as far as we know, his ultimate attitude towards it? And here he lays it out beautifully right here in 1969. He basically said no. That's it.
Yeah. And I guess one other aspect, too, because, you know, the like self-seeking free isles, like this was in the practice of Vanu section. And obviously this is 1965, you know, obviously after he was, you know, practicing Vanu and he was done with the Free Isles Project. But, you know, he might have been just laying it out too, like, hey, you know, we couldn't figure out how to do this. If you can, you know, have fun.
Yeah.
And do it. And, you know, I think that kind of drove, you know, I mentioned in the introduction that it at least had, you know, Werner Stifel was the Atlantis Project and, you know, the Preform Inform Project, actually, you know, had an influence on them. But, you know, I don't see any other direct examples, or, you know, direct connections with the other ones. But then again, I mean, there's still a lot of, you know, there's still a lot of, I've still got to do some digging for more information on these, but yeah, next week we're going to talk about, you know, Operation Atlantis. We're going to talk about the Minerva Project, Sea City Toluga, DuPont Caribbean Freeport Resort, Sealand, and then we're going to, you know, cover Hong Kong and Liberland as well, on top of that. So there were, you know, a handful, and these were all, you know, 1960s to 1970s. There was one project by, there was the Atlantis project. I think it was still Werner Stifel that was doing it. But if you go to oceana.org, I think it is, there was another attempt at this in like 1993 or 1994. But, you know, he gave up on it pretty quick once he realized that, you know, most people weren't going to. He didn't get enough support for the project. So there are a lot of examples we've got to look at next week. And, you know, just to kind of reiterate this, you know, the hypothetical scenarios we touched upon a little bit ago. Yeah, they're going to have an impact. They're going to lead to some of the demise of at least a few of these, and then some other. I mentioned some of the one of the other ones, which led to some. It's not directly, you know, it's not what Ray was talking about, but it was after a failed attempt they tried something else, you know, similar to that. So it'll be pretty interesting. So I guess, Kyle, do you have any conclusionary points there to leave the listeners with?
Yeah, I think I'll just reiterate what I said, I think, last episode or so, that, you know, if you were to set up like a private city or Freeport or Free Isle or Sovereign, whatever the heck, you know, versions thereof, you know, where does the capital come from in order to make that happen? And like I said in the Ethical Enclaves episode, you know, I disagree with the agorists about black markets abolishing the state, but black markets can be used for other purposes. And one of those purposes would be arguably to fund the construction, especially the infrastructure of like a private city. But I don't think anybody's even tried. And the main problem with the proposed and or current, I guess, private cities is that it's all white market funded, isn't it, ladies and gentlemen? Not even gray market, but white market. And because it is white market funded, that means that everything is tracked and regulated and taxed. And, you know, goodness knows only what else. So there's already, you know, ends means consistency, right? It's that old, you know, integrity thing one more time, you know,
which both Konkan and Rayo talked about.
Yes. Yeah. It's not just, you know, it's not just the ends. It's also the means. It's how you got to where you are. Function determines form, means determine ends. How you go about achieving something is just as important as what that particular end is. And so when it comes to how the free ports are potentially constructed and all that, yeah, I mean, it's pretty much got to be counter-economic, gray and or black market. And that's not happening, is it? It's all white market. And again, when we get into those examples in that upcoming episode, you know, I think I'll probably be right about this one, because I'm not aware of any private cities, libertarian or not, being black and or gray market funded. They're not like counter-economically being used by venture capitalists who essentially are not on the you know, New York Times pages or whatever the mainstream media newspapers are these days. You know, that's kind of the problem, right? Because a lot of the venture capitalists are people who do pay taxes and lobby the government and have public-private partnerships of one kind or another, which are fascist. And so I'm not necessarily saying it's the Coctopus one more time. I don't know, man. It might as well be, at least for some of them. And again, it's up to the listeners to make their own, you know, judgments about, you know, which is which. But I don't know, man. When Rayo mentioned here about, you know, Preform concerns itself mainly with self-liberation through neo-nomadic living, not the Freeport development. Yeah, that's it. Done. So it's part of his history. And it was a fair question to ask. And at least it does try to get away from political crusading, although I still think collective movementism would still apply because of the Cultural Revolution as mentioned earlier. But I don't know, man. I am not exactly running to the private city. So that's just kind of it. Now, is it like a wonderful dream? Is it something that would be consistent with principles? It could be, I guess. But then there's kind of other more practical considerations, not even so much of the like questions about like how do you protect yourself from, you know, a government that's trying to invade kind of thing. I'm not even going there. I'm thinking more like how do you even build the damn thing? And see, that's why are people still stuck in the suburbs? Why are people still in the servile society? Heck, I could say that about myself too, to be perfectly frank, not to self-flagellate too much, but it's kind of like, you know, why am I not running away to the promised land of liberty and setting up my own private city? And it's like, I don't know. I mean, if we also take a look at the off-grid homesteading thing, topic for another time, why is that so difficult to pull off in terms of having like a off-grid homesteading intentional community, dare shall I say? Because there's been some problems there as well. So, you know, that's getting into some kind of murky but yet necessary to examine territory, isn't it?
Yes, yes. So I think as we, you know, next week will be an interesting discussion on those case studies. But, you know, just as with season one, you know, excited to get to season two. And now that we're on to season two, I'm excited to get to season three because, you know, like Rayo had a lot of, you know, very interesting, you know, ideas. And obviously, you know, covering these in season two is important, you know, I think just kind of for the sake of Rayo's legacy and the things that he proposed. But, you know, season three, when we start to develop these things and really get to go, you know, deep into it and you go and get into all the nuance and minutiae and like really try to figure out how these things could function. I think that'll be, you know, a lot of fun and very, very beneficial. But I also do think this is beneficial as well, or we wouldn't be doing it. Right. You have to know
where you've been in order to know where you're going. And so kind of going through this, some of this libertarian history, I think is more viable not because it reduces opportunity costs, right? So we don't spend a lot of time and effort basically on things which have already proven to be failures because people who came before us already gave it, you know, the good old college try. And already made a go of it and was like, yeah, we tried this. So we got away from the political crusading and the anti-libertarian LP and those failures. And we tried this other thing, which did seem to be genuinely different, and then found out, yeah, kind of some problems there. So we're going to kind of document this and kind of make it available to future generations like us. And yeah, then pretty much, you know, we'll try and figure out other forms of direct action that actually have a chance of working.
Right. Very good. Very good. Anything else, man?
I would just say, you know, again, I can't emphasize mean time to harassment enough, right? Keep your expectations realistic, at least when you're starting out. Don't try to jump all the way to H level or you know, even E level, at least to some extent, right? I mean, take one step. You know, Rome wasn't built in a day, and abolishing the state isn't going to be done in a day either. Even if it, you know, even if, you know, there were privately owned nukes by, you know, libertarians or whatever, it's one foot in front of the other, you know, kind of like what some of the alcoholic, whatever the heck, recovery people call it, you know, take it one day at a time, right? Just take it one day at a time. There's no rush on this, right? Vanu is not an all or nothing thing, right? Don't kill yourself trying to achieve invulnerability to coercion, as it were.
Right. Very good. Very good. So that's all we have. The website is vanupodcast.com, and we'll talk to you next week.